Oh, I can't hear Mike anymore. Hello?
Hello. Hello, Cherubs.
Is anybody there? Mike, can we actually hear Mike? Yeah.
I hope so.
I think so.
Well,
we can.
He just wasn't talking.
Hello, Cherubs, and welcome to Fitness Unfiltered. It is I, Dan, and I'm joined by the other two, the marvellous two, the two that is Mike and Emma. How are you both? Let's start with you, Em.
Oh, thank you. I am very well. I'm not even sure if this microphone is actually plugged in, but I'm going to talk into it as if it is. Do you remember how long I was talking into the wrong side of it? And everyone was like, Emma's really quiet on the podcast. And I was like, oh, yeah, to turn the mic around.
But it doesn't actually matter whether your mic is on or not, because the most important thing is that it's filmed.
Is it?
Is it? I really hope not. I have a very shiny forehead today.
Mike.
Hello, I'm fine, by the way. But also, Emma, let's talk about your last weekend. What you've been up to. We know, because we were there.
It was great, wasn't it? We did the Level Up event. Oh, I've almost booked the venue for the next one as well. So everybody keep.
Everybody.
Oh, no, don't everybody. Tell us. I get stressed about dates. You're about to tell us a date I know.
24th and the 25th of September.
What are you
going
to say, Mike?
Don't tell me you've got something on.
Yeah.
How dare you?
I've got three things.
Really?
Who
books life that far in advance?
The BSLM conference.
Where's that? It's usually at the same place.
In London. Oh, damn this it. Year.
You have to choose, Mike.
Why not?
If you don't go, you don't love Emma. That's it.
I know.
It's cut and dry.
And you're probably homophobic.
Oh, my God.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, you're racist as well, maybe.
Probably racist as
well.
Well,
you said that. I didn't say that.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think we're going to try. I didn't want to say this in case we can't, but we were going to get someone to come and talk about diversity who's excellent. I need to confirm her.
I'm interested in diversity inclusion, not just because it's necessary, but more because as conscientious as people appear to be, I think sometimes for some organisations, it's a box-ticking exercise, like they're not going out of their way to seek the talent that would tick those boxes, more just to appear like they're ticking those boxes. Because they're kind of absorbing a lot of those roles.
It's very hard, and I do think it has to start somewhere, and sometimes it has to start with a bit of a gesture, because maybe actually the top people in that industry or in that space are all white men, because that's how it's always been, and actually genuinely they have the most experience and they maybe have the most education in that area at the time, and sometimes there needs to be almost forced diversity at least to start with.
But because it's also self-perpetuating, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, if you think about who do you ask to speak at events? Who do you ask to come on podcasts? People who you've heard speak at other events or be on other podcasts, or people who you see. You know, we don't know. It's not like, you know, if you're doing a speaking event, you don't put out an advert for who wants to be a speaker and do interviews. You know, it's not like a job application, for example. So I think the visibility in something in certain spaces, like the fitness space, is often based on who is already visible, isn't it? So it's quite difficult to manage, because even when we got some criticism when we did our Fitness Unfiltered live event, and the first thing that we sort of were thinking was, well, we've asked the people that we know, and the reason that we know the people that we know is because they're the people that we've seen speak at other events and heard on podcasts and stuff like that, and follow on Instagram. So it is a thing.
But also we did have a fairly diverse group of speakers.
Yeah, I know.
It was ridiculous.
Still aggy about it, but I think that's the thing, is that you can always, in those situations, you can either act defensively or you can reflect on it. And I think we are the kinds of people, I hope, that we always reflect on the discussion around it and why that has been made. And actually, in that situation, it was because there was simply one panel that we had that someone had seen an infographic for that happened to be four white women, I think, on the picture. So they had taken exception to that. They hadn't looked at the event as a whole. But at the same time, it makes you think, doesn't it? It makes you wonder, I think you always wonder whether you're doing enough good at anything, or a good enough job at anything.
Before we venture too far off, I think that's a nice seamless caveat into actually the level up event. Because as much as I admire bros chest bumping, high-fiving, arse-slapping at these business mentor type events, and there may have been some ladies doing that there as well, I don't know.
I had my arse slapped numerous times.
Yeah, at level up, it was nice to see. And I think you did. But, you know, that again, the unintentional diversity box. But having two women lead the way in that was, I think I said to you, I wanted to bring Mila along. It just, well, actually, I'm thankful I didn't, because it took me nearly 7 hours to get there. That would have been hell.
but Ant Park brought his daughter.
Yeah, that was so nice.
And like, yeah. I mean, it must have been probably quite boring for her, but she sat right at the front. And like, I guess at that age, you're quite impressionable as well. And actually seeing like it was an event run by Amelia and I, hopefully.
Well, also, like the proportion split, not that it was intentional. There was, 80% female coaches there?
Yeah.
Something like that. So again, yeah, unintentionally leading the way, but still leading the way and being the change that you want to see. I think it's a positive thing.
I like that. Be the change that you want to see. And yeah, I think the event was really good. I think honestly, the most incredible thing was the people and how engaged they were. And I think all of the speakers individually told me this. They were like, that was such a nice talk to give, because it wasn't, you know, like it's so hard to give talks at things like Body Power, where people are coming and having conversations, or there's someone deadlifting, or people are walking past, and then halfway through your talk someone else's talk starts and everyone's like, sorry, I have to go and see this talk. And it's like, it's really hard to keep concentration and to actually enjoy that, whereas it just felt like everyone was there. I mean, part of it was because we didn't have numerous things going on. We had this is the talk, this is the value, and you know, people really sat and engaged with it. And I think that's what made it so special, especially for the speakers, like actually to have to present to such an engaged audience. Is it
correct phrasing or appropriate to say? I felt that although there was a number of people, they were still quite intimate.
I think,
as you said,
yeah.
Everyone was engaged. It was an exchange. Everyone was participating as well. It wasn't just, and that was the different vibe that I got. People were contributing to the discussion. It wasn't just people arriving and being spoken to or spoken at. You know, everyone had the opportunity to contribute something really valuable. And from my point of view, really refreshing to actually see people that still fundamentally really care about the people they work with. They really care about doing the best job possible. And all the kind of things that we get frustrated with industry-wise is not the industry. The industry is what you make of it. The industry is who you surround yourself with. And actually, if you continue to surround yourself with people like that, you're going to end up a much, much happier person, I think. Because just as from a peer's point of view as well, all the other speakers there, they're all people I learn from. They're all people that I, you know, I hugely value their opinions on. So it was honored to be invited.
I also think like the mastermind discussion, I can't get enough of them. Like, I think they're so valuable. And it was interesting talking to Shona afterwards. She was like, within my mastermind, there were two people who aren't really in the fitness industry. So Dr. Hannah Ritchie, unsurprising that she gave incredible advice, but also Andy's wife, Laura, who is kind of in the fitness industry, but isn't in our space within that. She works in like leisure industry, and actually getting their input and their feedback and their perspective was so, so useful. And I think that's really underrated when it comes to business, is getting, you know, like it's one thing hearing what another personal trainer is saying or doing. I think what we probably don't do enough is listen to our clients or potential clients or people from out with this very small space within the industry to see that, well, actually this is how I would interpret that. And I think that quite nicely leads on to today's topic about calories on menus, where there has been, like with our kind of very niche space within the industry, quite a lot of upset and uproar about this. And then it's interesting sometimes to get people's perspective from the outside or different perspectives, where people are like, oh, like one, never heard of it, didn't even know it was happening. or two, like, well, I can't understand why that would be a negative. And three, I think like most people that I know have had, like from out with the fitness industry, have had those two, or, oh, I thought we already did that. Like, I thought we already did calories on menus. And because most places do. I mean, most bigger chains do, right? Nando's, Starbucks, whatever. You're kind of used to seeing that. So that's what we're going to discuss today, is thoughts around calories on menus.
Yeah. And with those changes, it's probably important to state that that's not every single business or every single outlet. It's large organizations with over 250 employees. So as a byproduct, I guess you could say that possibly it might support local businesses more if those people don't want to go to restaurants with calories on menus. But I thought I would get some data and some facts before someone's like outraged or furious that I've misworded something. So I thought that necessary. So like a lot of the data comes from, which is freely available from the House of Commons Library. And it was the health survey conducted for England in 2019. Obviously with the pandemic, there wasn't one. So generally as well, I think when people are outraged about public health messaging, they don't really think about it from an informed decision point of view. They don't think about the epidemiological data. They think about it more as a moral, personal thing. And I think when we've touched on this before, that's almost the danger of being too empathetic sometimes, is when you hear an individual story, you forget about the broader picture. And especially when it comes to like obesity and, you know, addressing social ills that affect the whole country, it has to be net benefit.
I did a post about this and someone commented something along the lines of, "Mom, I'm quite surprised that you don't care about anyone who has an eating disorder." And it's like, that's not what I was saying in the slightest. And you're right. Like, you have to have a broader view of this than maybe what your individual experience is. And also realize that maybe you've curated a space where it seems like a lot of people have those issues. And thankfully, in comparison to obesity, that's relatively small.
I think the reason that is such an issue, and the reason that it comes with so much sensitivity, and the reason that people snap back with you know, comments like that on social media, is because you are talking about a very disenfranchised and marginalized group of people who have a very, very, very hard time and who don't receive in any way near the services or attention to those sorts of services that they should in the world, and in terms of trying to get help for a condition that is absolutely heartbreaking. So you can imagine why everybody who knows anybody who's going through that or who has had any experience of going through that themselves is going to be in a very heightened sense of awareness towards anything that might make that really horrible situation even more horrible to them. So like, I get the fury with which that people respond to that kind of stuff. But like you say, there is, public health interventions are always going to look ridiculous to everybody, because, or not to everybody, but to the majority of people who talk about them, because you'll only notice them if they're something that bothers you. I think that's half yeah. the issue.
And it's also attaching morality to this. Like, I don't know whether anyone has noticed, but when it comes to the government, like, you can't really add moral value to it. So almost, I think, like, it's entirely separate conversations, because if you're just looking at the data, and obviously we fully appreciate people aren't numbers, so how we communicate this is hugely important. But if public health are basing their informed decision on data, the data states that is estimated that overweight and obesity related conditions across the UK cost the NHS 6.1 billion a year. And that 28% of adults in England are obese and a further 36% are overweight. That 28% of adults in 1993 was 14.9%. And obesity has increased across age groups up until 75 years. In comparison, 16% of adults aged 16 and over screened positive for possible eating disorders. And that's not to say that that still isn't a significant number, but I think we can be equally outraged and concerned about both parties. But when we criticise public health, you've got to understand how they come to those decisions.
I suppose also, and again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, because I agree entirely what you say, but you do also have to consider the impact of having an eating disorder on someone's life versus the impact of having obesity on someone's life. And obviously obesity has its risks and all that kind of stuff, but the vast majority of people who are overweight won't have anywhere near as much of an impact on their lives from being overweight as someone with because an eating disorder is a much more significant condition, I would say, in itself, in terms of its risk of morbidity and mortality, then, because it's quite an extreme level if you've got an eating disorder and physical risk and stuff like that. But
I don't think they're comparable. Like, I think that,
well, exactly,
even and even like you're kind of looking at two things and being like, it's all like we're making the assumption that putting calories on menus is gonna improve obesity rates, and we simply don't have the data to support that. And we actually have data that disputes that. So there's numerous studies that have been done, and these were done over in America, that found that actually putting calories on things don't make people choose lower calorie options. Now, I presented this data in a nice little post, and most of the people, well, some people under it were like, well, it does for me, blah, 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 which is absolutely fine, but you're not the target audience. By virtue of following me and being in the fitness industry, you are not the target audience for this. Actually, it's more like general awareness. And we know that from research, that isn't what happens. Like, the people don't see the calories and make lower calorie choices. In fact, sometimes it makes things worse because they're like, oh, it's only 500 calories, I'll have two, or I'll also have a dessert, or that means that when I go home I can also have blah 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 blah.
And which is even more of a significant issue when we know the inaccuracy, when these foods are being made by human beings in a kitchen who aren't measuring stuff out gram by gram. They might have a recipe to follow, but they're not, you know, they're putting a spoonful of oil in the pan, they're not kind of measuring out how much they're using. So actually it's likely to be very inaccurate anyway, which means that then if you are relying on those calories as a way of, you know, of factoring in things and stuff like that, then likelihood is that you're going to get it wrong anyway. So it's actually potentially going to confound the issue.
Yeah, although I think all calorie tracking is inaccurate anyway.
Of course.
And the way that your body processes different foods.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can argue this, but I think it is, like, it's probably useful to for people to know roughly how much energy they're taking in if they're trying to diet, for example. But most of the responses I got were from people who, you know, already track on MyFitnessPal and are like, actually, and I think for that distinct group of people, I was speaking to my friend about this, she was like, when I was prepping for a photo shoot, I wouldn't eat out, whereas if I'd known the calories, I would have, right? Such a niche group of like, oh yeah, maybe for those people that would have been really useful. I think on a broad view of this, like, I just don't think, well, there isn't the evidence to suggest it works. What we do know is that, like, nudging behavior seems to work slightly better. So there's pretty incredible research on showing that even just things that are free, like, this costs a lot of money to do to the businesses, but also, like, I guess going through government, blah 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 blah, when McDonald's changed where they put Diet Coke in comparison to Coke on their, like, swipe through menu, it reduced the amount of Diet Coke the amount of Cokes that people were drinking by 60%.
Yeah.
Like, that's a ridiculous amount just from swapping where those things are, or swapping the default. So another study on this, when I think this was done in Disneyland. Yeah, it was. So they swapped the default of, like, soda to juice, and they swapped fries to fruit and vegetables. And that reduced people's calorie consumption by 21%, simply by swapping what the defaults are.
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of stuff we should probably be implementing on a like government level.
And so do you think actually that the aim of this, because I suspect that the aim of this is not in any way to actually help people make choices. It's more to put pressure on the food industry and the restaurant industry to stop being so ridiculous with their calories. Wagamama.
I think it is. I think it's partly that, because places like, interesting, like KFC have pledged by 2025 to reduce the calorie content of their recipes by up to 20%. So because they do have to disclose that
up to 20%
information, it does add pressure on them. Sorry.
I was just saying how, like, great wording by them. Yeah, we might reduce it by up to 20%.
Yeah.
But you know what's really fascinating to me about, you know, and having been on, you know, in situations where I've done a lot of dieting, I've tried a lot of low calorie alternatives, and we know that a lot of low calorie alternatives are horrific. I'm looking at you, cauliflower rice, that sort of stuff. But actually, when we've got stuff like air fryers and things like that, and lots of ways of actually making food taste incredible without just dousing it in oil like we used to in the like 70s and 80s, it just seems slightly odd that we can't use those things, because actually, I mean, a lot of fast food that is really high in calories tastes like crap. And this is what frustrates me, is people have this idea that if you reduce calories, you know, you're excessively restricting yourself, you're not letting yourself enjoy a night out. I'm sorry, like, pleasure and joy are not proportional to calorie content in food, 100%.
Yeah, I absolutely could not agree more with that. I think it's a false dichotomy a lot of people create for themselves, like, well, do you know what, you only live once, so may as well eat all the donuts. Okay, like, could you not have fun without excessively consuming calories? Yeah, you probably could. I actually think I'm way more impressed with a cook if they can make like a calorie conscious-ish, you know, not a ridiculous calorie meal, taste phenomenal.
Yeah.
Like, it's quite easy to make, yeah. I say that being the worst cook in the world, but I'm like, it's quite easy if you just pour a load of like fat and sugar on stuff to make it taste nice. But actually what's way more impressive is if you can make something that that tastes good, that isn't a ridiculous number of calories. Yeah. Sorry if we seem a bit weird, but Dan just dropped out and we're like, where is he?
Where is Dan? Come on. I'm just keeping an eye on the waiting room because he should be back. But yeah, I mean, I went out for lunch the other day and I was like, I'd quite like to just, like, I'd had a big breakfast and I wasn't massively hungry, so I wanted to order something light. And so I just, it was like they had like grilled fish with like new potatoes and vegetables. And I was like, oh, brilliant, that's perfect. That's kind of exactly what I want. And it was absolutely swimming in butter. And I was like, you have ruined this like delicate, nice meal that I wanted by trying to make it taste better by simply pouring fat all over it. And it was like, it wasn't that that was making it nicer. It was that it was ruining it. But people think that it makes it better.
Welcome I think back, that Dan. That's a very good example of where like actually calories on the menu might be really useful, because people would be like, do you know what? I really want the burger, but I'm going to go for the healthy fish. And then later on, I'm going to know I had the healthy fish. Yeah. So I'm going to overeat at dinner and not realizing that it's swimming in oil. And actually it was probably more calories than the burger.
Yeah, I had a really interesting conversation actually with a friend the other day. And I was fascinated because this is someone who isn't anywhere related to the fitness industry. And so somebody who I assumed, like you were saying earlier, was not going to care about this at all or be interested in it. And actually, she was saying that as a mum, it really concerned her because she felt like that she had been really lucky to grow up in an environment where, you know, she didn't feel that she really had any issues with food, because there wasn't any kind of restriction around her, and there was no kind of issues fostered around food and how much that should be had. And it was, you know, it was a very healthy kind of food environment for her growing up. And she feels really fortunate that she's had that situation. And now that she worries bringing up her kids, that they're going to, the first thing that they're going to see on these menus is, what is this? They're going to start learning about calories at, you know, at potentially quite a young age, and start, you know, discussing it and talking about it with their friends and comparing what different people are eating when they go out for, you know, for food with their friends when they're teenagers and stuff like that. And I did actually think that was really fascinating, because I guess, you know, we've talked a lot about in the past about how eating disorders are, you know, often a manifestation of other kind of underlying mental health conditions or issues with control and things like that. And actually how that's one of the things that does concern me about this decision, is that that kind of facilitation and the shoving in people's faces of that, who might be susceptible to developing problems as they're growing up, for example. What do you guys think about that?
I think like one of the biggest factors, and when it comes in, if we're mentioning children as well, is the socioeconomic impacts of it. And when they looked at this public health survey, it was that those children that were severely obese were up to 4 times higher in the most deprived areas. So a byproduct of this could be that by pressuring those companies that typically pop up in these most deprived areas, it could possibly mean that the calorie consumption, the calorie controls around those foods are better. But almost it makes you question, and, you know, from all the framing around obesity I find in the UK, it's all fear-based. It's always like tackling obesity, when arguably if the most deprived areas is such a factor and children are such a consideration, shouldn't it be dealing with the poverty issue in this country.
Especially with
the cost of living, inflation, everything now. I mean, part of me is a little bit like, oh, what a privilege it is to worry about what's on the food menu, because more families than ever are going to be pushed to food banks and not really going to be thinking about what their foods consist of or the caloric content of them. It's just going to be, is there enough to feed their bellies? Mm. You know, and that is one of the biggest considerations when you go into a supermarket and it's five meals for a fiver, which is made up of whatever calorie dense, you know, high fat, high sugar, etc., or a pint of blueberries for £4. It's kind of a no-brainer for people that are struggling, I think. And we are, there's such a disparity now in that there are people that literally that last tenner is going to go on electricity for their flat or whatever it may be, and picking up food at the food bank. I don't know. There's so many different ways to think about this, but I think the UK just seems to get it wrong, especially like the narrative around tackling as well. When we look at images in the newspapers and it's, you know, people in larger bodies, and if you don't want this to happen to you, then you must not do that, and all this sort of thing. Whereas if we really wanted to help people, we'd be addressing the things at the root, I think.
Yeah, and we'd be doing more to support, I guess.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's the environment. And what I was thinking as you were talking, Mike, about the woman who was saying that she kind of, I guess, grew up in a different environment. And I wonder if actually you would, quote unquote, get away with, you know, being less energy conscious, calorie conscious now, given that I would say even in the last kind of 50 years, like our diets changed quite a lot. And as a young person with more freedom and, you know, disposable income and people with like, you know, cards that they can tap and just get their lunch and blah, 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 like you're probably more exposed to really high fat, fast food, really high calorie foods that if you don't have an awareness of them, then you probably will become overweight in that environment. Like it is becoming more and more an obesogenic environment. And I'd be interested to know whether when she was growing up, like I know when I was growing up, I had no concept of what a calorie was or how many calories were in food. I mean, that was only 30, well, I'm 30, right? So that was only like 20 years ago. And I was relatively active. I never thought about what I was eating particularly. There was a lot of like junk food around and I probably ate a fair amount, but I moved a lot. Now, if I wasn't massively into sport, like probably would have been overweight. And I think
it's food environment at home as well, though, isn't it? There's such a huge cultural element.
Well, accessibility, like my family cooked from scratch all the time, which is probably why I wasn't overweight as a child.
It's an accessibility, but not everyone has that as well. Luxury. Yeah, because I don't know about you guys, but it was always end of week, I would pick something up from the sweet shop kind of thing. Whereas with deals on like 4 for £3 and children actually taking chocolate bars, crisps, and it's a totally different world. I don't think almost it's comparable. And obviously with social media, I think that has a huge impact as well in terms of raising awareness of these things. I think back even when I first got into PT at 19, I weren't savvy about calories even then, and that was supposedly part of my job.
So I have to say, my cousin taught me about calories when I was 10. And I had a pretty good consciousness of calories. And I considered myself overweight at that time, even. I mean, I used to get made fun of as being fat. So I didn't really have a consciousness of what overweight was, whether I was or not. It's just kids make fun of people for whatever they decide to make fun of people on that day. I don't even know if it's even relative to actual reality. But I remember having a consciousness of it, but it never developed into really being that bothered by it or actually trying to learn about it or anything like that. And I think that's the difference. Actually, a lot of the time with kids, it's not so much that they will have an issue with something until they've got an issue with it. And then by then it's, you know, you can't decide what kids have an issue with a lot of the time because they're exposed to so many different environments. They're exposed to so many different people. So, you know, while my food environment might have been healthy at home, that was not going to stop my cousin from teaching me about calories when I'm out with other people or friends at school or, you know, people in other sorts of environments and stuff as well. But
I think I don't know if this is massively jumping or not, but you know the meme that always goes around and it's like someone outraged that they're talking about homophobia at school or something, and like, oh, two people kissing, like that's going to make everyone gay. No, it's not. Like, it's just awareness. It's it's awareness that these people exist and that they are here, and that's fine. It doesn't mean that
if I keep making that sound, it's like the aliens are here, they're amongst
these
us.
People
these people.
Well, I'm so glad that Florida, like, though, I can get away with that.
Florida is actually, it's illegal to teach in the curriculum for primary school.
But this is what I mean, right? People think that knowing that trans people exist is going to make more children trans who weren't going to be trans.
Or talking about calories is going to make people
have eating disorders. And it's like, I don't think it will. Maybe it will contribute. I think if someone already has an eating disorder, it can be quite triggering for them. But I also think, like, if you're going down that route, one, they're either not eating at restaurants or they already know roughly what those calories are. And I guess it's for the people that are maybe like in recovery and don't like are trying to eat more but don't want to know about the calories that are on that menu.
No, I was just going to say, because I think it's almost ironic, the narrative around it, because of the people almost that address the complexities and the nuances of obesity and, like, breastfeeding being of influence, home environment, social facilitation of eating, all these other things that impact why people are obese. It's not as simple as calories in, calories out. It's exactly the same with, it's not exactly the same, but it's just as complex with eating disorders.
There's comorbidities
with, mental disorders. There's hereditary considerations, the genetics to consider. There's so many other things to consider. So this reductionist attitude that we have where it's just, if you do this, this will happen. It really bothers me. And I was probably ranting about it on my stories today, because I find that this, even with the anti-diet activist, it's, well, you know my feelings on certain medical professionals, for example, that are very health at every size, which there are very valid points to bring up, and there's huge nuances around that. But not acknowledge that anyone anywhere would benefit from intentional weight loss. I think it's unethical.
And I think my honest opinion on this, and obviously I've reflected a lot on this, and I think that what happens when people are in an activism space and develop an audience and an environment, again, you know, we're all very much influenced by our audience and our environment. When you're surrounded by people with a certain type of vulnerability, it's very difficult to remove yourself from the fact that very difficult to recognize the fact that other people have different vulnerabilities, and those vulnerabilities are incompatible with the vulnerabilities that you're concerned about, right? So you can almost just focus, quite understandably, if you're an activist for something, it means that it's probably one of the things that you're most passionate about, and the people that you are advocating for need you to be fully focused on that activism, right? But then, is that compatible with having nuanced, reasonable discussions about scientific issues? I think it can be, but I think
can it be evidence-based, though, if you're not addressing that nuance?
I think that's the point, is that you have to be addressing the nuance. And I think some people in the activism space do still address the nuance and do still accept it. But as a result of that, they're not very successful in their activism space as other people who disregard it. And I think that that's why, when it comes to stuff like this, we do, you know, you sort of need, you do need activists to argue for marginalized people, because they need to be advocated for, right? But at the same time, you can't forget the other side of the argument simply because you're advocating for that. And I think that's what a problem is. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that social media is such an absolutely horrifically bad space for having these discussions, which is why it's nicer to talk about it on a podcast, is that you just, I mean, you get, like, someone commented on my post saying, well, actually, that evidence shows that people's behavior does change by knowing the calories. And they even quoted a statistic about the percentage less that of fewer calories that someone's likely to eat if they're on the menu. And I said, oh, cool, could you signpost me to where that evidence has come from? Because I haven't seen it. But nobody did. So then you end up in this situation where you hear statistics and you don't know what's true and what's not. And then people are just saying things like what they said to Emma about you don't care about people with eating disorders. Well, that's true. That's not true. You care about truth.
And that's true. She's a bitch. She doesn't care about anyone apart from herself.
That's the sound bite everyone's going to take from this.
Yeah. But I just think it's tough. And then on the other hand, you've got people, you know, you've got sponsored ads from you know, companies who are basically saying, don't worry, we've got a calorie-free menu. And, you know...
Go on.
What I struggle with is when content is paid for, and I get that content has to be paid for because people have jobs and people are, you know, people need to make money, and I don't.
You're not allowed to caveat.
I am, because again, there's nuance, but at the same time, you then do need to look at the intentions and the motivation behind certain situations. Like, so for example, you have got certain restaurant companies that are advocating for the fact that they have got calorie, like menus that don't display the calories, which is great. That's really helpful. But then when you actually look at the calories of the foods on their menu and you see that some of their simple, you know, main course items with no added extras, when you're actually also expected to be ordering sides and starters and other things and drinks that have got loads of calories in them as well.
Hypothetically, Wagamama's katsu curry, which is over 1,000 calories.
Yeah, 1,200 calories. For chicken and rice is, you know, you can sort of see why people might like, why does a chicken and rice need to have 1200 calories in it? I mean, I'm sure that you can make a chicken katsu curry for fewer calories than that. In fact, I've made one myself, but I'm not advertising my own cooking services over Wagamama's, but I just think like there's obviously something to be gained from the fact that actually fewer people might want to order their food when they know that it's 1200 calories. And I know they're being transparent. I know it's on their website and people can find it out if they want to anyway. And I suppose you could argue that they're just offering another option for other people. But you could also argue that if we're talking about this being part of the government putting pressure on restaurants to reduce their calories, and actually if people don't care about the calories unless they're shoved in their faces, and then therefore it doesn't affect their income, then they're not going to reduce the amount of calories in their food either.
Also, so, if we know like anything from behavioral science, it's that people don't go out of their way to look for information they don't want to know about. Like, people don't check their bank balances when they know that it's low because they don't want to see it. They don't want to know about it. So if it's not there in front of you, you're probably going to avoid it. You're probably going to put your head in the sand and just be like, I don't want to see it, which is fine if you don't want to see it for some, you know, and that might be the best option for you. But I think the only way that this would probably work to sway people's decisions would be for it to be there, even if they're not looking for it.
Yeah. Informed decision, right? Informed choice. At least it is an option. It's not for us to nanny people. Like, you know, you can look at things on a menu and not look at everything that's in that dish, for example.
And I would also argue that if we're talking about healthy psychology and healthy decision making, I know we don't live in an ideal world, so we can't just give everyone healthy psychology. But actually, if it's something that is a trigger and that is a problem, then should we be hiding the number of calories on the menu, or should we be trying to work on offering the right amount of the right kinds of support to the people who are affected by it, to actually deal with and address the underlying issues that make them that way? But I suppose you could say the same thing about obesity.
It's a brilliant point. I'm sure that anyone who's struggling with an eating disorder doesn't want to feel triggered by calories on the menu. If you could get to the root cause instead of just like putting blinkers on them so that maybe they won't be able to see some of this information, like, that would obviously be better. Now, is that a much harder thing to do? Yes, absolutely. Is getting to the root cause of obesity a harder thing to do as well? Yes, absolutely. But there are certainly things that we can do probably better, and it'll be interesting to see the stats on this when it comes out.
I mean, it's almost like our discussion isn't, I mean, I think we're on the same page. It's not to discuss whether it's right or wrong. It's just to assess the severity of impact. Also to critically and objectively look at why public health come to these decisions. because it does, it makes sense. If you just look at that from a numbers point of view and you take all morality out of it, based on the numbers, because of that public health investigation as well, 80% of people agreed that they thought it would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're surveying the country and 80% of the country think it would be helpful, along with rising stats that are contributing to those pressures.
I mean, not to go too far into this, but a lot of the ways that you ask like leading questions and people get like, do you think it would be, you know, you've said here that you want to lose weight. Do you think it might be helpful if you knew all the calories of the things you consume? You're obviously going to be like, no. Like, yeah, of course you would say yes after that. So I think there's a whole other argument, which could be a whole podcast in itself, but like action and intent. Like also education is not enough, like knowledge is not enough. How many people, like how many nutritionists or personal trainers do you know that also struggle with their weight? Like tons, right? It's not just knowing what to do, it's actually actioning that. And I think that's like, that's the link for like successful coaching to me, or and on a broader scheme, like public health messaging. How do we get people, because let's be honest, most people will be able to tell you, how do you lose weight? You eat less and you move more. But they're not doing it. They're not actioning it. And you need to link, like bridge that gap between action and or intent and action.
Yeah.
So I think if anyone's tuned in summary, make up your own mind. But at least we've touched on some of the really important points. And I think that's kind of the crucial bits that, unfortunately, again, with social media, short segments and short captions don't really give you opportunity to convey all this important stuff.
But yeah, and I think that like the main argument is it going to do more good than it's going to cause harm? And I think if we go off the data that it doesn't work, then it's a really awful thing that we've done. Like if it's triggering a lot of people and it's upsetting a lot of people and we don't even think it's going to work, that was a very bad decision.
Yeah, I think we can all conclude that generally with like the UK's, even the language they use, as I said, like tackling obesity, should they just be tackling poverty? If that's the biggest contributor, is that the real issue? But then, you know, then we get into a conversation about a Tory government and Partygate and 50 quid fines.
Let's not get into that one.
And why Rishi Sunak's wife's decided to pay millions in tax for him to hold on to $150,000 a year job. But hey, I'm not going to go into it.
Oh.
Politics.
Ooh.
I'm definitely not going to go into it.
Okay, well, on that note, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah, share if you care.
Tar very much.
Love you, bye.
Bye.
Bye.